This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
It's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And of course, on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And it's my pleasure to have someone on the air who hasn't been around the past few weeks, but I know she's there and she's always here in spirit. One of our favorite guests, her name is Katie North. She's a senior finance policy analyst with Bloomberg Government. Hello, Katie.
Hey, Alan.
So you are little Miss Busy. You're never, when I go to find Katie from time to time, and she's traveling. She's here. She's there. She's meeting with customers up in New York or traveling out such and such place to speak to people. You are, and it's because of the gigantic brain that you have in your head. And all the information you have about Dodd-Frank. You are Miss Dodd-Frank here at BGov. Tell us about where we are at this point in the process. Are we on track? What are some of the milestones we've reached up to this point?
Yeah, so November was actually a pretty fast-paced rulemaking period that probably the most rules came out of the major financial regulators in the past 6 months.
Right.
So it was very active. I think we'll see another active month in December. But overall, we're still, you know, just about 60% of the way through full implementation. Now, the regulators, and in particular Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, has been very adamant that the vast majority of Dodd-Frank will be implemented by the end of the year. But I think that, you know, obviously there's still a lot left outstanding.
Did you see the look on my face? Did you see that look I just made? That was like, really?
Really? Right. I mean, there's very few weeks left in the towards the end of the year,
right,
as we know. But also, even if some of these rules are released by the end of the year, which I'm doubtful that that's going to be the case, we still have a very long implementation phase for many of the rules and regulations, particularly those around capital, mm-hmm, and also around the Volcker rule. I mean, we're looking at seeing the Volcker rule next week, but that's not something that's going to be fully implemented for a year and a half.
It's funny you mentioned Volcker rule. Just a few weeks ago, you put a BGov insight together. Volcker rule gets a boost in post-nuclear Senate. Walk me through why that is. Give us the foundation for this.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So there are five regulators who are looking at the Volcker rule and have to approve it. And if you tally up the number of bodies that sit on those commissions and agencies, mm-hmm, there are 23 individuals. And interestingly enough, because of, you know, nominations processes and people rolling off, there's going to be about four or five people who may have been languishing under the old Senate rules for months and months as it relates to getting on their getting in their positions as commissioners,
mm-hmm,
with some of these major regulators. But now with the Senate able to approve these nominees in a much quicker fashion, we probably won't see that happen. And one of the main areas where this was going to be a problem is on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. There are three. Gary Gensler's rolling off in January. Bart Chiltern is leaving. And then there's currently an open spot on that commission. So feasibly, by January, we were going to have only two commissioners there, which is not enough to approve anything.
Right.
It's certainly not enough to get any kind of agreement because one's a Republican and one's a Democratic.
Total disagreement at this point.
Absolutely. And so that's a major sticking point,
right,
as it relates to some of these rules that require multiple agencies to buy in and approve it. But as a result of the nuclear option, I think we'll see we won't see that sort of dire straits kind of activity happening.
Still nothing before January. Do you envision anything actually becoming on paper before January?
We are going to see a Volcker rule next week, and it may not be something that all five of the regulators buy into, but shortly thereafter, we may get consensus around all the five regulators.
Interesting.
And it's really most important that the banking regulators, mm-hmm, approve this thing because it is a rule applicable only to banks. And those banking regulators, the FDIC, OCC, and the Fed, obviously are going to bear the brunt of the enforcement requirements for looking at the Volcker rule.
We're just scratching the surface of this Volcker rule, however. I mean, there's still a lot of work left to be done. correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. So even once we get the rule in whatever form it comes out in, if it's a reproposal or a final rule next week, we will see a lot of discussion and debate continue to happen around all of the so-called risk metrics that they've proposed in the past and what that means for banks as far as compliance costs and if it's even feasible or realistic for this type of data to be flowing to regulators and how everyone will digest it. That's been one of the biggest questions for me is how can you possibly digest all of the millions worth of data points on these issues looking at transaction level data to figure out whether or not it's proprietary trading. It's a difficult proposition no matter how you look at it.
What would our colleague Chris Payne say about the Volcker Rule? If he were here right now and you could speak on his behalf, what would he be saying at this point?
You know, I think he would talk in terms of sort of the comparable things that are happening overseas with ring fencing and taking a look at it. You know, ultimately what banks have tried to do in the past is manage their long-term interest risk on mortgages and other long-term kind of loans outstanding with shorter-term kind of liquidity risk management. And proprietary trading was one of the kind of ways that they did that. It may have gotten out of hand in some certain instances during the crisis, but ultimately, you know, as of now, a lot of the banks have really just siphoned off that really bright line proprietary trading, and all that's left is hedging and market making, but it's difficult to see if you look at any transaction level data, if you're hedging sort of one particular risk or you're doing more of a macro hedge like that occurred somewhat similar to the JP Morgan London whale issue, is if you're doing something very large to manage a broad amount of risk, is that going to be illegal or is that not going to be illegal? And that's what we're looking at as it relates to this proposal next week.
So with the amount of data that there's going to be, obviously, and you mentioned just a moment ago, how in the world are we going to be able to ingest or digest all of this information and fully understand it? Would you have a suggestion? Could you inject yourself into the process and say, here's what I would do, because I've got a big brain, I'm Katie North, and I'm really smart.
Well, I think one of the things to do is to look at trends. I mean, you're not going to be capable of looking at, you know, individual transactions and trying to make a call. But what you can do is set up sort of a tripwire system where you can take a look at activity that maybe trips a couple of the wires and then go in and maybe do some further analysis on those transactions. And I suspect that's what the regulators plan to do. It's really just a matter of how much the banks have to be active in monitoring that process or if it's really just going to be a data flow in system and then the Fed and the other regulators will be looking at it on a regular basis.
Are you saying you're available for consulting purposes at this point?
I don't know if I really want that.
Throwing yourself out there. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is Katie North, Senior Finance Policy Analyst with Bloomberg Government. And a few months ago, Mary Jo White, about 7.5 months ago, to be exact, took office as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. How have things changed, or have they changed?
Rulemaking has been up pretty significantly, about 40% or so, since she took her role as the chair. And I think that is largely due to the fact that, you know, she had trouble. There was trouble before with Shapiro getting consensus on a lot of things and digging into some of the other issues around corporate governance. And we've seen that Mary Jo White has been able to come in and sort of, you know, deal with that consensus building a little bit more offline, perhaps, but also change things organizationally in staff time and trying to get all of these rules done. And you're not going to have multiple staff working on different rules. You're going to have people dedicated to getting a rule out. And so I think that's really changed the workflow at the SEC. And she's really been able to get a lot of these rules out for proposal at the very least, but finalized a lot of rules too. And so I think we'll continue to see that at the SEC because many of the rules related to credit rating agencies, like I mentioned, the corporate governance issues, those had all languished for over a year at the SEC, and we had been waiting and waiting for a lot of this information, and now you're starting to see this stuff flow out of the SEC. Mm-hmm. And I think those are some of the core issues of Dodd-Frank that many folks would agree really needed to come out, particularly around this credit rating agency issue.
60% complete. She basically came in and improved their operational efficiencies. She just came in like a consultant and said, why do we have 11 people working on one thing? We can have one person focusing on one. Is this something that we could see spread, maybe? Could she all of a sudden, I don't know, spread like a virus across the government, and all of a sudden everybody starts adopting her ideology? Is that possible?
I don't know. I don't know if that's possible. I think one of the challenges at the SEC is really they had the vast majority of the rulemaking requirements under Dodd-Frank, mm-hmm. significantly more than double than many of the other agencies. And so they had a lot to do, but they also had a lot that could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what we're finally seeing, is the SEC coming around and marking off and check box, you know, and some of the things that had languished.
Interesting. Things that they need to work on. Where is their pain point at this point? What kind of things are they working on next?
Yeah, so the Jobs Act is something that they still have to fully implement. Mm-hmm. There's one big piece of that, looking at Regulation A+, which allows private companies to remain private and raise additional capital. That's something that we'll see very soon. We'll also see some additional action on corporate governance issues, probably somewhere in the round of the first of the year, looking at employee hedging, looking at clawbacks and golden parachutes and those types of things, and making some changes there, as well as finalizing some rules around executive compensation disclosures.
Right. Something that we were just discussing before, I mentioned it at the top of the show, you do a lot of traveling. You're all over the place, talking here and there. You're going to have an opportunity in the coming weeks to discuss Dodd-Frank with Dodd and Frank in the same room.
Yes.
How did this come about, and where are you going to be? Tell us about it.
It's pretty interesting. So Market Council, which is a group of investment advisors, they are having a big conference in Las Vegas next week and invited me to come and have a discussion with Chris Dodd and Barney Frank. And I think it's going to be really interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
If you could see the grin on her face right now, she's like a kid in a candy store. Like, oh my gosh, I'm going to talk to the guys.
So I, you know, honestly, I think I could speak to them for hours and hours. Of course. I have about an hour on stage with them.
Right.
But
you're going to give them your phone number, and you're going to get theirs, and you guys will chat offline and Twitter, right, and be friends on Facebook and all that good stuff.
Right. But it will be very interesting, I think, to kind of look at things from a little bit more historical perspective, mm-hmm. now that they've left Congress, taken a step back, and really just sort of it'll be interesting to tap into their knowledge on this, right? Because they were the foremost experts,
right,
in the Congress,
right,
on these issues. You know, I'm interested to hear from them what they think, where they think the leadership's coming from, where they're most concerned in terms of implementation, and what they think we can, you know, what the regulators can do better at this point. Certainly we'll talk about systemic risk. Certainly we'll talk about, you know, other areas of regulation, shadow banking and hedge funds and things like that. So it will be a really interesting discussion.
So they gave birth to this baby and set it off to sail, and now it's growing. Has it grown far beyond what they ever imagined? Is this something that these are the problems, this is what we need to address? Or is it something that they were like, whoa, we didn't even think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to get their perspective on that. Is like, do they think there will be another financial crisis that'll look like what we've experienced? Do they think Dodd-Frank will have an impact? Should there be another financial crisis?
Wow.
There's a lot of questions. It's going
to
be interesting.
I expect to see pictures at Katie North on Twitter of you and Dodd and Frank. And if you want to follow along, you can follow Katie at Katie North, that's C-A-D-Y North, on Twitter. You can follow me at Alan L. Scott, and I'll probably have retweets of her stuff because she's smart, and I can't say the things nearly as intelligently as she can. So anyway, hey, Katie, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Alan.
I appreciate it. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. To learn more about Bloomberg Government, simply call us at 877-498-3587. Bloomberg Government.
Bloomberg Government.
Where business and politics come together. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, where my next guest, senior healthcare analyst Mr. Brian Rye, is about to make us all very upset with his latest piece. FDA seeks to ban trans fats. Are salt and sugar next? Insert ominous music here.
We aim to please, Alan. How
oh
are you?
Oh my gosh, I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing fine.
This is disturbing news, and all you have to do is a simple search on trans fats on the internet. More than 100 years. Did you realize it was 100 years ago that these trans fats came about? 57 years after they were first linked to health problems, they now decide that these were probably not good, and we're going to get rid of them. I still remember the day that I saw my very first Crisco tub. And did your parents ever cook with Crisco?
Of course.
No? Okay. And then they would collect it afterwards because you got your good, you got your fresh batch, and then you got your leavings.
Fish fries and hush puppies.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, all of a sudden, this is bad. Why? What is the FDA doing to us?
So this is the next step in a process that the FDA actually began probably about a decade ago. Right. In 2003, they mandated that companies have to list the trans fat information on the nutrition label. And I think that started in around 2005. And some companies sort of had already gotten the hint and had slowly either reduced or even eliminated the use of trans fats, finding other substitutes. And with that in mind, I think the FDA noted that the average American's consumption of trans fats had already fallen from about 4.5 grams per day in 2003 to just 1 gram per day last year in 2012. So, Alan, you're getting healthier, whether you know it or not.
Yeah, okay.
But what they're doing now is taking an even more, I guess, firm step, and they've made what they term a preliminary determination that these are not generally considered safe for food. So what that would mean from a company's perspective, so if this preliminary determination moves forward, you as a company would have to ask the FDA for permission to include these partially hydrogenated oils, trans fats, in your food. And the FDA, if you can read between the lines, is more than likely going to say no.
Of course. When that happens. Because they're not a fan of flavor. They're not a fan of food that tastes good. I'm not forcing people to be unhealthy. I mean, let's face it. When you hold a piece of bacon bacon. My mouth waters just mentioning the word. You hold a piece of bacon to a paper towel or a napkin, it turns clear. That's the goodness. That's what makes it taste good.
I'm sure the FDA would say that there are other things that can help it turn clear for you. And so what we have here is we're in the middle of a 60-day comment period. So in our analysis, we actually provide a link to the Federal Register notice and the site where people, if they want, can make comments on this. This comment period ends in January. But by all indications, they're going to move forward with this. From a business standpoint, probably going to hurt the smaller mom and pops.
I was just about to bring that up because that's what BGov is all about, the business implications of government actions. And if this goes through, that little mom and pop donut shop is going to have some troubles.
It's tough. They rely on trans fats because for all the badness that the FDA is going after, they, from a business standpoint, give you a longer shelf life, give you lower production costs. And whereas in McDonald's or General Mills had already sort of moved away from trans fats, smaller mom and pops who don't have that those economies of scale, will be facing some business difficulties and some tough decisions to make. But therein potentially lies some opportunities. I think you'll see a resurgence of some of the saturated fats, canola oil, palm oil. I think the folks at Dow Chemical and DuPont are developing new oil seeds. And the Canola Association was quick to come out with a press release talking about the new high-stability canola oil that's out there. So there'll be things that happen. Necessity is the mother of invention with this. But you get the sense that trans fats within the next couple of years will be a thing of the past.
Let me get my bacon with some extra olestra, please. That's good eating right there. So this is obviously something you said 10 years ago is when they really began down this road. And the comment period is currently open. By the way, we're speaking to Brian Rye. He's a senior healthcare analyst, and he's recently written FDA seeks to ban trans fats. Let me slow down. FDA seeks to ban trans fats. Are salt and sugar next? And that kind of leads me to my next point. We have found, or they have attempted to find, replacements for these things. And we talked about, you just mentioned Dow Chemical working on some. We've already gone down this road with regard to sugar. People are looking at replacements like, Truvia and Sweet and Low and various other things that are deemed healthier than the actual sugar itself. What, salt? Really?
Well, it's tough, and you're right. The sugar substitute market is about a $10 billion market itself right now. Probably will grow 30% over the next several years.
I've tried them. I don't like them. I want real sugar.
Again, that comment period is open.
I'm taking notes right now.
But salt is a bit tricky. There have been lots of efforts. The CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, down in Atlanta, has released several studies, and they've noted that in over 40 years, voluntary or efforts to try and get voluntary reductions in the average American's daily salt intake just haven't worked.
Right.
And so, you know, from a public health policy perspective, putting aside the politics of whether or not you think this is right or wrong, there probably is some justification, especially on the heels of if this is successful with the trans fats, they'll be looking, gaining some confidence from that, right. And maybe salt would be next. Salt substitutes, although, are a bit tricky themselves because, you're talking in many cases about potassium chloride instead of sodium chloride. And thinking back to 10th grade chemistry a long, long time ago.
Is that a Breaking Bad all of a sudden?
Yeah, we're not going that far.
No, okay.
But the issue with some of those is if you have diabetes or chronic kidney problems or even liver problems, most medical professionals say that you can have problems excreting excess potassium. So potassium chloride might even be worse than sodium chloride,
right.
For certain populations. So, from a business perspective, maybe that you start seeing new types of salt substitutes come down the road, or a switch to the herbs and spices, and maybe new combinations to try and the Mrs. Dashes of the world, or McCormick, a big maker of spices, Pennsy Spices. I mean, those types of companies, might come up. If I were in their shoes, I'd be coming up with new cookbooks.
Sure,
The salt free way to
McCormick right down the road in Baltimore. I'm sure is working on something to get ahead of this.
So going back to the grand theme here, the FDA, I think, is very clear in their intent to remove trans fats, artificial trans fats, from the nation's food source if they can. And again, I don't get the sense that they'll be satisfied with just stopping there. I think there will be a push, and there's enough public health data and emphasis out there that something like a salt or sugar could be in the crosshairs next.
I've joked consistently about the fact that I've got like mayo running through my veins and such, but this is something that's very important. In fact, Margaret Hamburg, the FDA commissioner, said that this could potentially prevent 20,000 heart attacks a year and up to 7,000 deaths. So removing trans fats from the American diet is something that is necessary. I'm just concerned, let's face it, it's all about me. I'm worried about how my food is going to taste, whether I'm going to be happy about this.
Well, and restaurants, they want you to be happy as well.
Of course, I'm not going to come back if I'm getting a bland thing. They're going to have to come up with something chemically enhanced to make me happy.
And I wouldn't, there are folks working very hard to do just that. Yeah. Your local bakery, your restaurants, they want, you're right. You actually bring up a good point that, the onus is on them to retain the customers that have gotten used to a certain taste, a certain texture. With whether you're talking about pancakes, biscuits, cake frostings, whatever. And so now you have to come up with a way to do that. And again, we'll see what happens in the next few years.
Business implication of government actions. They say that this is an overdue ban on trans fats. In fact, Michael Bloomberg was behind this dramatically many, many years ago, trying to get this ball rolling. And they're saying he may be the forerunner of this effort.
You New York City banned them several years ago. State of California did as well. So again, there is a precedent for what the FDA is trying to do on a national level.
Yeah. Would you say that, do you like salt? Are you a sodium person?
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
I'm to the point where I put salt on pizza. My wife gets really upset because she'll make something, she'll smell thyme, and I'm sure if you cook something or your spouse or fixes something, I'm one of those people that will season it before I ever taste it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how do you know it's going to be, how do you know I didn't already do that? All right, well, you're right, I didn't, but I season, I taste, and then I season to taste.
Again, the CDC said that it has...
I'm one of those potential heart attack victims.
All voluntary efforts. It's just been a tough road to get people to reduce their salt intake voluntarily. And again, you have a personal liberty discussion. You have all kinds of very meaningful discussions. But strictly from a public health perspective, you see the need to do something if voluntary efforts just aren't producing that effect.
Doctors out there, feel free to tweet me at Alan L. Scott. Tell me how bad my diet is and urge me to switch. I will do my best in doing so. The piece by senior healthcare analyst Brian Rye is called FDA Seeks to Ban Trans Fats. Are Salt and Sugar Next? It's a BGov Insight, available on BGov.com. Brian, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
And with that, we put the wraps on this week's edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me on Twitter at Alan L. Scott. I'll catch you again next Thursday with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.